Hello and welcome to the Great Lakes Analytics and Sports Conference, Sports Analytics Podcast. I'm Scott Tappa, Director of the Conference, and I'd like to invite you to attend our event June 21st at the University of Wisconsin-Stevens Point. We have a fantastic speaker lineup taking shape. Please visit www.uwsp.edu/analyticsconference to learn more. Today I'm speaking with one of our presenters, Adam Grossman. Adam is founder and CEO of Block 6 Analytics, and at the Great Lakes Analytics and Sports Conference, Adam will deliver a talk titled, The Impact of Star Power in Determining Player Value for Sports Teams. Adam, welcome.
Good to be here.
All right. So let's just start off like I start off with all my guests. Tell me a little bit about your background. How did you get in analytics, and what led you to start a business in the space?
Yeah, absolutely. So Block 6 Analytics is a sports sponsorship technology and analytics company. One of our products that we'll be focusing on for the conference is the revenue above replacement model. And I think we're going to go through that in more detail. But just to give a holistic picture of the company and the background, the reason I started the company is because I developed an interest in analytics while I was in business school. In between my first and second year of business school at NYU Stern, I worked for the Washington Capitals, and essentially a project came up where the Capitals created the first female affinity group in the NHL, so female fan group. And they were looking for to find a sponsor, and the sponsorship team didn't have a good way of pricing the sponsorship or displaying the information to a potential partner. And I thought there was a way to do that. I realized then that, the Capitals were then and are now a very progressive team, obviously, both on the ice and then off the ice, given that they're at this moment, they're obviously in the Stanley Cup Finals. But if they didn't have this type of information, I thought other teams wouldn't have this type of information. So I built out a evaluation model using concepts that I learned in business school, particularly financial modeling, and then some deeper data mining and analytics concepts, and applied those to the sponsorship space. From there, we realized that it wasn't just teams and leagues and events, that it was the buyers, the brands and sponsors that work with corporate partnerships. And then from that, in part, I co-authored a book called The Sports Strategist, Developing Leaders for a High Performance Industry. As, taking the concepts that I'd applied to my business, I applied this approach, this type of quantitative approach, which is really an asset valuation approach or a derivation of an asset valuation approach used by investment banking firms, private equity firms, venture capital firms, in order to determine the value of different assets. And I applied it to athletes. In particular, it did not seem like athletes were necessarily compensated on their holistic value that was derived for a sports team or sports organization. So because of that, again, I mostly did it originally as something for, you could take the concepts from the book I was writing, and here's an example of the way you could apply those concepts in the real world, so to speak. What I didn't realize is that it actually was similar on the sponsorship side. There actually was a demand for this type of holistic valuation, particularly focused both on the on-field but on the off-field side as well. And having that and creating that from the concepts of the book is a way that we developed this specific model that we'll be talking about in the conference. So it really is, I always had an interest in the sports industry. I went to college at Northwestern where I played soccer, but I never really thought or considered a career in sports. And what I discovered is that having a quantitative background and being able to take quantitative concepts, use them in innovative ways and communicate about them effectively really could separate myself and differentiate my company in the sports industry, and from there, that's how we've gotten Block 6 Analytics.
All right, good answer, good holistic answer there. So, you mentioned on field versus off field, and many of the people that I talk with about sports analytics, it's based on game strategy or player development, things like that. The value of the 3-point shot in basketball, shifts in baseball, things like that. Whereas your business focuses on the revenue side of business, sponsorship, and things like that. Has sports been as quick to incorporate analytics off the field on the business side as it has on the field? And how would it compare to other industries that you're familiar with or that you've worked with?
Yeah, it's a really good question. What I've traditionally said is that the sports industry from an off-field perspective has been where baseball was before Moneyball hit. It was essentially, there were people who were doing advanced analytics in baseball. Obviously, Bill James had been publishing, I think, some version of the baseball perspective since 1978. And the book Moneyball came out in 2002. So clearly there were people, looking at advanced analytics concepts on the on-field perspective, but it wasn't pervasive in the industry really until after Moneyball came along. And now, like you mentioned, that on-field analytics are definitely a robust part of virtually every team in all the major sports. I do see that changing pretty significantly, particularly in the past 12 to 18 months on the off-field. You can just look at sports teams and look at their, you know, front office staff or their employee roster, and you see more and more frequently, you know, directors of analytics, managers of analytics, managers of sponsorship analytics, you know, people who have CRM experience, people who have data science experience. That has really been a fundamental change. And that's not just on the property side or the sell side. It's also on the buy side with brands and agencies. There are more and more people who understand analytics. And the reason is, you know, one is, you know, understanding the value, whether from sponsorship or athletes or media rights deals or dynamic ticket pricing, analytics can have a direct and immediate impact on revenue growth in ways, as you refer, that it's happened in other industries. You know, dynamic ticket pricing is not a novel concept. Airlines have, you know, for example, have been using it for years. And, you know, ironically, you know, the on-field use of analytics stems from off-field characteristics, particularly from business considerations of companies like airlines, and understanding, you know, airlines and automobiles or airlines, automobiles, and probably consumer product goods are probably the most commonly used or ones that used analytics and most commonly used analytics. So the sports business has definitely moved and progressed a lot recently, but it's really, you know, looking, you know, I think it does still lag behind other industries, and it does still lag behind where it could be, but there's definitely a recognition that these types of things are important, and a recognition that people really need to understand the quantitative pieces of what's going on from the business side of sports.
Go back to something you said in your last answer about how athletes are not necessarily paid commensurately to the value that they bring. It's true. I never really thought about that before. Is that... how can I say that? How is that similar to or different than an employee in any other sector? I mean, couldn't that be said about, you know, my job, your job? I mean, in what ways is basically any employment category somehow inefficient or not matched up to the value that they provide from a strictly dollars and cents point to their organization?
Yeah, it's a really good question. And again, it's something that we really thought about, or in particular, I thought about when I first developed the model, and then we as a company has really thought about. The way that players are typically, you mentioned it a little before, but the way that players are compensated now is based on their perceived value to help a team win in the future, and based on how other people are paid for that particular position, based on their perceived value to help them win, right? That is not how a sports organization only makes money. What we are looking at is what is the impact of winning on revenue streams. And we typically identify six core revenue streams. And those are traditionally some version of game day, which includes ticket sales, concessions, parking, media spend, sponsorship, events, IP licensing, and merchandise. And then, you know, all of that kind of folds into subsidy revenue. So you could make that a sixth or seventh category. But it really should be, if you're looking at what the value of any employee is to the organization, you really can look at it from two factors. One is, what is the revenue that's being driven by that employee to the organization from a top line perspective? Or what is the cost reduction that's being driven by that employee to help maximize profitability? So you can look at it from a purely financial perspective. You can also look at it from a brand marketing perspective in terms of how is this employee helping to improve or enhance my brand in substantive and tangible ways that drive interest, engagement, and sentiment in the company that we're talking about. And from a monetary perspective, sports organizations, we do find consistently there is a relationship between winning and revenue generation, but that is certainly not the only factor that is driving revenue generation. There are teams that are stars, and there are players that are stars, and the teams and leagues in particular have spent millions and millions of dollars on on marketing themselves and their players and their organizations, so that, you know, if a team is winning or losing, there is some amount of interest in the either in the team, the league, or the event, and that is to their credit that they're able to do that. But also, it should be that, you know, athletes, people are coming to see a lot of times, or at least in some amount of time, what we would consider a star athlete. Regardless of how the athlete performs, they want to see that athlete play. You know, obviously, And again, there are athletes that perform well both on and off the court. You know, LeBron James probably being the most common example. But there are definitely athletes who perform well off the court who don't have the level of performance on the court. And people still will come to see them play. For a time, you know, when Johnny Manziel was on the Browns, there were definitely people who were coming to see Johnny Manziel no matter how he played. And if you're able to drive, you know, revenue, attendance, engagement, players should be compensated for that. So just as a summary, you know, what we look at in our revenue above replacement model, which is our core model that looks at overall athlete valuation, we look at on-field factors, off-field factors, and earned, you know, personal performance, which you can think of as earned media. On-field and off-field are really about direct revenue generation. In particular, how does a player's performance and how we isolate a player's performance and his individual contributions to revenue and say, what is that contribution and how valuable is that to that particular team in that particular sport? From a personal performance, that can be arguably more oriented towards earned media, what is traditionally thought of as earned media, which is how is the player generating interest, sentiment, and engagement outside of, you know, owned and operated channels by a team or an organization. So, you know, when LeBron is doing campaigns for Sprite or for Nike, there is some, you know, ability for some of the fans to be associating with the Cleveland Cavaliers, and there should be some value that is being accrued by the Cavaliers for what he is doing in those channels. So again, if you're talking about employees, typically the way employees are compensated is how do they impact their revenue? How do they impact our profit? How do they impact our brand? And you wouldn't just compensate them on one aspect, or in theory, you should not compensate them based on one aspect. You would compensate them based on their total ability to impact your business. And you should be able to draw direct lines between what they are doing and not what their perceived value is or how other people are being compensated. Now, to be clear, there's definitely a, and I know this is a really long answer, so I apologize, but to be clear, there is, you know, you're going to have to look at the market and see what people are paid in the market. That is a factor in our model. But what we're really trying to isolate is somebody's individual contribution to the team and really compensate them based off their contribution to a team.
So, okay, so you mentioned LeBron, and I just started thinking, when's the last time I saw LeBron in an ad? And he's ubiquitous, so you see him all over the place. But you mentioned the Sprite ad. And the last one I saw him in, it was that baseball-themed one, right, where he's wearing like an old-school Oakland A's-type uniforms with Sprite's colors. So there's no Cavaliers branding on that, all right? So by your model, by your analytics, how does that Sprite ad where LeBron – with no Cavs branding, how does that positively impact the Cavs? And maybe I'm misinterpreting this, but just thinking of the example you gave with the team and the athlete, just give us a sense of how that influences the results of your model.
Yeah, I mean, I think you can look at it. Why is Sprite working with LeBron James, right? Sprite is working with LeBron James because he is obviously a very successful basketball player and has achieved success off the court. The reason he's a successful basketball player is he plays for the NBA. Most of the people who know who LeBron James is know that he plays for the Cleveland Cavaliers. So even if he's not specifically wearing a Cleveland Cavaliers jersey, there is obviously, if not all, then most or a majority of fans are likely to know that LeBron James plays for the Cleveland Cavaliers. So our model would discount this to a certain degree, but our model does discount, you know, this would be an increase in brand awareness or brand perception. An increase in brand awareness or brand perception does have an economic value to a team, but it is definitely less than direct customer acquisition and direct customer retention. Our model accounts for this fact by saying an increase in brand awareness or perception makes it more likely for somebody to make a purchasing decision. If they're more likely to make a purchasing decision, then they're more likely to actually purchase something. But that, again, that is a two-step process to get to that point. So those types of impressions, both from a sponsorship and from a player, you know, performance perspective, are usually not as valuable as more direct acquisition. So if he were actually selling tickets for the Cleveland Cavaliers, or if this was a direct way that they could use LeBron as part of a sponsorship, that would be more valuable to the Cavaliers because that's direct revenue generation. And again, we would value that more highly in our model because it is helping them with a specific goal of, you know, again, increasing their top line revenue growth.
Okay. Anything else? I feel like we indirectly just segued into the topic of your conference presentation, the impact of star power in determining player value for sports teams. Anything else, just top line, high level that you want to tell us about the revenue above replacement replacement model?
So we've applied it in the NFL. We've applied it, you know, in Major League Baseball. We've applied it in the NBA. And you definitely see, you know, again, holistic value and overall contribution does not necessarily mean that a player is being undercompensated. In fact, there are players that will be overcompensated, again, because their perceived value by a team or is higher, or that in terms of helping the team win, or that people who are comparable in comparable positions are making that monetary figure. So it's not just to say that this is a blanket statement that athletes are underpaid. In fact, like we said, there are times when athletes are definitely overpaid in our model. That being said, you know, we really do want to focus on what that holistic contribution is. And yeah, you know, for whatever reason, sports teams, particularly when it comes to the player, you know, player compensation, really do want to focus only on an a player's again, value to help them win. That is not an accurate or reflective way of their contributions. What it also is an indication, and again, there's basically two silos when it comes to sports organizations, right? There's the team operations side and the business operations side. Those sides often don't interact, and it's often that, you know, a player is signed or drafted because of this idea that they can help a team win without any thinking about the marketing, branding, or sponsorship components. And on the flip side, when the sponsorship team or the marketing team or the digital team is looking to run a campaign, they're often not necessarily talking to the coaches about the players, even though the coaches arguably know the most about the players of anybody and could provide really interesting insight about how to run these campaigns. And that's really a problem. And we see actually leading organizations, the Chicago Cubs being one of them, where, you know, Theo Epstein, you know, the president of the Cubs, actually has sat in, I think still does sit in on sponsorship meetings to articulate what the team's vision is and what they're looking for and how they want to position themselves. And again, that's Theo Epstein, obviously he helped both the Red Sox and the Cubs, teams that had been long suffering franchises from a winning the World Series perspective, win championships. So it's not like he's not able to do what people would consider his core job successfully. But he, you know, the Cubs recognize that having these integrated components of an organization is really important. And hopefully this revenue above replacement model is a step in that direction, where again, if you're looking at asset valuation and looking at what the holistic value of a player is, you can go to a player, or, you know, a player can go to a team, an agent can go to a team can go to an agent and say, let's start the conversation from what is the full value. And if we start the conversation from there, it makes it easier for us to really get to a contract that works for both the team and for the player.
You know, as you were just saying that, it occurred to me though that, you know, while business side and
oh, can you hear me? I can't hear you. Can you hear me? I can't hear you.
How about now?
Yeah, I can.
Can you hear me now?
Yeah, I can hear you.
All right. I'm sorry. I don't know what happened there. Anyway, I'll just repeat the question. You know, while the business side and the player acquisition side of it, the roster management side of it may seem like they're often divorced from one another, it seems to me like in these industries where salaries are capped, right, because each team operates within that environment, that the value that a franchise could deliver for sponsorship, you know, individual sponsorship deals would really be a driving factor in a player choosing a certain franchise at times. I mean, is there a potential for a team, for a front office to say, yeah, you know, we can offer you the same money as X franchise, but, you know, look at our history with comparable athletes. You know, we can deliver 25% more value to you as an athlete. Is there a potential for those types of views?
Yeah, absolutely. So what we try to look at within the context of our model is we look at athletes across different markets and see what their value is across different markets, so that you could say, here is the value for a player in New York versus Los Angeles versus you know, potentially Milwaukee or Chicago or Florida. That's the idea behind it. So yes, there are different teams that can potentially get different levels of value. So that's absolutely something that you could absolutely use as a team to say, look, we can help you deliver value and deliver and potentially help from an endorsement marketing perspective. That's been the case. So a version of that has been the case when people said, you know, people will want to sign in New York and LA because that's where the biggest audience is and where you can get the most endorsement deals. That really has changed pretty substantially in terms of you don't necessarily need to be in larger markets, although that definitely still is helpful. You can really maximize your brand in a variety of different markets. You know, Kevin Durant, while he was in Oklahoma City, is a good example. You know, he was able to sign lucrative contracts from an endorsement perspective, even while playing in one of the smallest markets, you know, in the country. But what you really want to think about is exactly that. Is, you know, one of the things that we actually just wrote a blog post about this in part today, but it really is, you know, how almost the opposite side is really how does a player help a team generate direct sponsorship growth? You know, having a player, having an athlete, having that player's platform as part of an overall campaign can be really valuable. We specifically see that we also have created an NBA jersey patch index for this season. The jersey patch is a new new sponsorship asset where, in addition to the Nike logo being on the jerseys, you know, specific companies have paid, you know, ranging usually from a couple million dollars a year to $20 million a year with the Golden State Warriors and Rakuten to have their logos on those jerseys. And part of the reason that Rakuten wanted to do that is because of the exposure that the star athletes like a Stephen Curry, a Klay Thompson, but what's, you know, Draymond Green, Kevin Durant had, right? And the idea of leveraging the star power of those players to help generate revenue is definitely something that can be and should be more effective, you know, can be, you know, more used or more easily used. In particular, we've seen in our jersey patch index, we see when star players are featured in posts that they generate a significant amount of value. And when you're talking about social media, a lot of times the social media audience can exceed the live television audience for a single post within a single channel. We really focused on Instagram for our jersey patch index, and we saw that Bleacher Report on its own was able to generate, you know, millions of views for specific posts that drive significant value for the brands in the that had the jersey patch associated with that specific team. So absolutely, your original point of teams being able to communicate to players and getting a competitive advantage because they understand how they could potentially build their marketing base is absolutely something that could be done. And it's a really good example of, you know, that's an excellent example of how you could apply this model. And on the flip side, again, understanding how the players can really help build out the sponsorship, you know, build out partnerships and build out sponsorships is also something to consider as well.
So you mentioned Rakuten, and I, for whatever reason, just noticed that they were the Warriors jersey sponsor the other day when I was watching one of the Western Conference Finals games. They're also Barcelona's yep. jersey sponsor, correct? So how do you differentiate the brand lift from the Warriors sponsorship, which is, you know, relatively small and is basketball, you know, but a worldwide audience, but versus what's derived from the sponsorship of Barcelona's jerseys? Also, you know, one of the most famous teams in the world, probably a more popular worldwide sport. How do you differentiate that?
Yeah, so Rakuten, you know, we don't work with Rakuten, so I just want to be clear, but we've written a post about this. Rakuten, with the different partnerships, has different goals. With the one with the Golden State Warriors, yes, there definitely is a large international component, but one of Rakuten's core goals is to actually increase its brand awareness in the United States. One of its companies is Ebates, and I think people in the United States are more familiar with Ebates than they are with all the things that Rakuten can provide. So the idea of leveraging the Warriors to really build its brand awareness in the United States is a core example of why it worked with the Warriors. Also, obviously, the deal size is much smaller, even though they pay the most of any jersey patch partner in the NBA, the deal is much smaller than the one they did with Barcelona. And in part, the Rakuten deal with Barcelona is, rather than focusing on one geography, it is more of an international play and not even necessarily in Europe. You know, there's a huge fan base both in Asia and potentially in Latin America that follows Barcelona, particularly given the star power of Messi in Latin America. That is factored into that analysis. And Rakuten, you know, has been a company that started in Japan. It does have a significant presence, or is trying to increase its presence in Asia, but clearly it's trying to increase its international presence. And using FC Barcelona as a tool to, you know, yes, to enter the European market, but expand its influence in the Asian market as well. That's a different play than what they're doing with the Golden State Warriors. So it does, you know, what our model looks at, and you bring up a good point, is what is a specific goal for a specific opportunity? You just brought up a really good example. Rakuten may not have the exact same goals, even for the same type of, or even for similar types of activations, right? They might have a different goal for the Warriors than they do for Barcelona. So we need to factor that in to see if value is being delivered, as if each team is meeting the goals of Rakuten, depending on the different partnerships and the different, what their goals are with those different partnerships.
Okay. So your colleague Leslie sent me some, forwarded me some links to some stories that you've authored in some pretty big media outlets. And the first one I clicked on was the one you wrote for Forbes that was ranking revenue above replacement performances for NFL quarterbacks during the most recent season. And I was reading, and it was interesting in that, you know, the headline mentioned Tom Brady and Carson Wentz. And then I scrolled down and I saw Mitch Trubisky from the Bears was number three. And you know, again, promising young guy, high draft pick. But, you know, not an all-pro level quarterback yet, not a household name by any means. Give us a little sense of how Mitch Trubisky ended up as your number three quarterback in these rankings.
Yeah, I think this is actually an example, going back to an earlier point, is, you know, where you said, it could teams provide a better market for a player? And what ended up happening for Chicago is there is this weird, well, not a weird, probably a unique circumstance where it is the, you know, Chicago is the second or third biggest market, depending on how you define the Los Angeles market. But it's definitely the biggest market with a single team in that market, in terms of just the market size, with Chicago being the third or fourth largest city in the country, depending on how you define the city of Houston. So the idea of, you know, the idea of a particular player in a large market that generates, you know, that has significant interest, but really no star players, by far the only real star player, you know, and the primary star player, the primary people were interested in was Mitch Trubisky. That doesn't mean that the Bears don't have good players, you know, Jordan Howard obviously being one of them, and Tariq Cohen starting to get some, an example of a player that started to build his star power, build his audience. It's just Mitch Trubisky was by far, in our model, the biggest star. And his contribution was almost entirely from an off-field perspective. In terms of the factors that we primarily look at from an off-field perspective are jersey sales and social media audience, because those are ways to isolate individual variables and individual contribution to revenue and individual star power. So, you know, the fact that Trubisky dwarfed pretty much everybody else on the Bears from both a jersey sales and social media perspective, particularly in terms of overall engagement and overall value that was generated for the Bears, that really separated him out. So the fact that he was, you know, on a team that had few stars, but still is very successful financially, in large part, you know, given the revenue streams that NFL teams command, particularly from a media perspective and the television rights deals. So if you're saying, you know, who are people essentially tuning in for? Who are people wanting to see from a ticket perspective? Who are people, you know, really engaging with? In this context, and for the first year, was really Mitch Trubisky. So that disproportion, you know, he disproportionately outperformed. I don't know if necessarily that's something that will continue, particularly as the Bears add, and, you know, as they anticipate get better and add, you know, potentially more star players to their roster. But at that moment for that season, Mitch Trubisky was somebody who we found to be particularly valuable.
You know, scrolling down in this story more, I laugh because then the next chart here has the top RAR performances by non-quarterbacks last season. And four of your top 10 here are ones that my 8-year-old nephew, who's nominally a Packer fan, you know, in suburban Milwaukee, asked for these jerseys for his eight-year-old birthday. And his OBJ, Todd Gurley, Antonio Brown, and Stephon Diggs. And he was super happy and excited to get those. So I almost feel like he's the case in point for your
reference. That's the best way to validate the model right there.
Yep, exactly. So we've been talking for a while now, and I appreciate the time. So just in the sake of wrapping this up, give us some reading ideas that would help people better inform their knowledge of analytics in the business space, whether it be sports or not. Whether it's a book, website, blog, maybe it's a podcast that you like listening to. What are some examples and some suggestions?
Yeah, I mean, I guess I wouldn't be a good entrepreneur or marketer if I didn't plug my own stuff to a certain degree. But the sports strategist, which I mentioned before, probably more applicable to this conversation, is a book that was recently published called Sports Management Analytics. That actually, not just my chapter on sponsorship, but it has a very good overview of how professionals in the industry are looking at analytics. And it's definitely a good baseline book for people who are looking to get involved with analytics. And I would say that's definitely a good thing to look at. And, you know, in terms of some of the things I look at, not just purely from a maybe more traditional, but from a financial and what's going on in the sports business perspective, you know, the things I take a look at in the morning are typically a version of this new, relatively new newsletter called John Wall Street that has a lot of information from a financial perspective, Synopsis, which does a good review of what's going on in the industry of sports. And then Front Office Sports also has a lot of good information about the overall industry and where it's going and, you know, potentially, you know, making things more applicable from that perspective. When you're talking about analytics and, you know, some of the concepts that I listen to outside of sports, your readers may or not be familiar with this concept, this new group of people who are part of, which they jokingly refer to themselves as the intellectual dark web. And it's because they're talking about ideas that, you know, in theory, again, in a sarcastic way or with a wink that people aren't necessarily talking about. But there are some people from that there who do talk about interesting concepts from that perspective. Jordan Peterson, whatever you think of his political views, does infuse a lot of data and information. In particular, he's looking at how people are successful in organizations, and he's identified specific factors using, you know, multi-factor, I believe is multi-factor regression analysis to identify success within the organization. Eric Weinstein, he's the managing director of Peter Thiel's fund. He's often appears in these types of podcasts and within these, both in podcasts and events. So again, that's a lot of different pieces. I would say, you know, really where you can really add value also is, you know, the Northwest. So I'm also a professor at Northwestern's Masters of Sports Administration program. The MSA program has a sports analytics track where you can take four courses and really get a good view of what's going on from a sports analytics perspective. If nothing else, looking at those courses and seeing what are the reading materials, what can you take a look at, how can you build out your analytics skill set? You know, not necessarily, I mean, I hope you would go to the program, that you can definitely gain a lot of benefit from going to the program, but as a baseline, you know, looking at that, you know, the book I mentioned before, Sports Management Analytics, looking at the reading list and looking at the potential, syllabi of those classes and the overall course views, you know, following, I mean, there's just a ton of people, if you're talking about on-court and on-field stuff, that have information to take a look at. But particularly if you're interested in the business side of sports, those are a really good place to start.
Great. And just to circle back to Adam's book that he co-authored with Irving Rain, and Ben Shields, it's called The Sports Strategist, Developing Leaders for a High-Performing Industry. Found it easily enough on Amazon. So check that out if you're interested. Adam, where can people find out more about you or follow you on social media or on the web?
Yeah, so if you're talking about our website is block6analytics.com. S6 is spelled out, so it's block S-I-X analytics.com. On Twitter, we're at block6analytics. If you take a look at it, if you do a search for us on Facebook or LinkedIn, you just do a search for block6analytics, and we should be the first company that pops up.
All right, very good. My guest today has been Adam Grossman of Block 6 Analytics, and at the Great Lakes Analytics and Sports Conference, Adam will deliver a talk titled The Impact of Star Power in Determining Player Value for Sports Teams. Thanks for taking the time to speak with me today, Adam.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Great, and thank you for listening. Again, the Great Lakes Analytics and Sports Conference will be Thursday, June 21st at the University of Wisconsin-Stevens Point. Visit www.uwsp.edu/analyticsconference for details. And make sure to follow us on Facebook and on Twitter at @analyticsconf. Thanks for listening.